Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'm Matt Kelly.
And I'm Matt D'Ancona.
And this is the two Matts for the week ending Friday, the 7th of July. And we're both here to give a new European view of the week's events in politics and a bit of culture as well.
Very much so. And a big welcome to our listeners. We're delighted to have you with us.
Thank you, by the way, all of you who've tuned in.
Big thank you.
I was really happy to see us feature in the podcast charts.
Yeah, we are the Wham of podcasting.
I don't think Wham were that successful straight off the hoof.
No, they weren't. They were kids, kids.
They could only hope.
They could only scratch the surface.
Only hope for success like this.
Yeah, wake me up before you go.
Well, let's hope they've not gone already.
No.
So, Matt, what did we talk about this week that people are about to listen to? We hope.
We talked about the minuscule status, both physically and politically, of Mr. Rishi Sunak.
Yeah.
And how the party is being engulfed by very strange nationalists who are easy to mock, but actually it's a worrying trend in conservatism.
Yeah. How so the sort of tectonic plates of the Tory party
it's
are
becoming
moving.
A party of identity, not the economy.
And we also talked about social media.
Mark Zuckerberg's challenge to Elon Musk's Twitter.
Yeah.
And we discussed Musk mocking Zuckerberg and talking about the false happiness of Hide the Pain.
I'd make a good...
Hide the Pain.
Make a good title for the show. So this is the Two Matts, Episode 3, Hide the Pain.
Hide the Pain.
So, Matt, what do you want to talk about this week?
Well, I love the cover piece this week.
Of the New European.
The Giles
Very
Wells.
Kind of you to say so.
Well, you know, I mean, partly I'm paid to say so, of course. let's be quite upfront about
short
this. You know,
full contract of employment.
It would if I'd said, God, you know, what are you thinking, man? No, I loved it. And I thought it was very incisive and intuitive about what's gone wrong with Rishi.
Because we should explain to the handful of listeners who haven't subscribed yet to the New European that it's a photograph of a big desk with a big telephone and a big flag, except they're not really, they're just normal size, they're a very very small Rishi Sunak beneath the headline Little Britain and how Rishi has diminished the UK.
Giles nails it, which is to link it into the 1980s, which I think is a really intelligent way of doing it, because the thing that has always struck me as the kind of most telling thing about Rishi Sunak is that when he was at the Treasury as Chancellor of the Exchequer, he had behind his desk a picture of Nigel Lawson.
Yes.
Which is very odd when you think about it, because Nigel Lawson was Chancellor in the mid to late 80s, which is a long time ago.
That's right. And not your natural pin-up material.
It speaks to one of the worst problems the Tory party suffers from, which is the notion of the unfinished Thatcher revolution.
Yeah.
And Sunak is a absolute example of that. And I think that's one of the reasons why what we're witnessing at the moment is not just the sort of decline and fall of the post-Brexit Conservative Party, but the end of a kind of imperial period that began in 1979 and is now, I think, drawing to a close.
Yeah.
But, you know, Giles really sort of nailed it, and how Sunak has a sort of series of beliefs about growth and so on, which are, you know, totally have their roots in the 80s. But what he doesn't understand is that the 2020s are totally different.
And well, that was the most depressing part of the piece, really. And, it, you know, there's no getting around from it. It was a depressing read because what he was saying, he said, you can draw comparisons with the 80s if you like, you know. And, and in many ways, you know, where we live now and at the time we live now is immeasurably superior to living in the 80s when lots of things were very miserable, high unemployment, you know, a sense of kind of real malaise and none of the sort of and massive dysfunction between geographies, regions in the country. You know, you talk about levelling up now.
I mean, it was
step back in time and
no-go zones for police.
We're literally talking about a period of time when the Conservative government was talking about running Liverpool down, for instance,
it was
just closing
close to social segregation. You know. Really.
So he makes the point that actually our standard of life and the way of life we've got now is immeasurably better than it was in the 80s, but the good thing about the 80s, from one small perspective, was that there was a sense of purpose and ambition to all the pain.
No, definitely.
That the, you know, whatever you think of Thatcher, and I've got very strong views about Thatcher, but whatever you think about it, at least she had a vision that this is going to be very painful, but it's going to get us to a place of growth. And the comparison with today is that this is going to be bloody painful and it's just going to be painful and it's not getting us anywhere. It's just to pay for the mistakes that we've been accounting.
There's the best that they can offer is maybe we'll bring inflation down eventually.
Yeah. Well, this is one of his five key pledges, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Halve inflation. What was the inflation rate when he was talking about halving it?
It was about 10. And so it's got to be down. If he's going to meet his target, it's got to be down to 5-ish by Christmas, which he's not going to reach.
And it's not going to happen.
No.
And the other thing that I was really struck, which I thought was a very clever point to make by Giles, was when Rishi Sunak said, we've just got to tough it out, we've got to hold our nerve, Giles asked the question, who was he talking to? Who was the we in that? And he concluded that the we in that sentence was not the great British population. Yes. It was the Conservative Party. It was specifically the Parliamentary Conservative Party. Yeah. When he said, we've got to hold our nerve, he was talking to his backbenchers, saying, we're going to get through this. We're going to come out the other side, because it's impossible to reconcile with any logic that sentence, you've got to hold your nerve, with the utter lack of ambition that these measures are going to achieve and the immediate impact that they're having on people's lives, as you've just described. You know, people are really suffering out there.
And there's middle-class economic insecurity to an extent that wasn't in the 80s as well, which is new. I mean, on the Parliamentary Party and the party Sunak took over last year, I mean, the best measurement of how he's failed as a leader of a party is that that party is now basically fragmenting. And we saw this week the launch of the New Conservatives, which reminded me of that old song, you know, everything old is new again. I mean, they're new, but they are very reactionary.
Yeah.
And they brought in this term, which is a euphemism, which is cultural insecurity.
Yeah.
Their obsession is driving down immigration. But what was interesting was they launched this 12-point immigration plan, which included things like no recruitment of care workers from overseas. Now, there are about 165 vacancies in the care sector. Yeah. It's broken, right?
So 165,000.
It's 165,000, sorry. Yeah, yeah. And so to actually say no is insanity.
Yeah.
And also then they're want to make it more difficult for the best and the brightest from abroad who come over here to study to stay, you know, in the middle of a massive tech revolution where we want those people to stay, you know, and participate in that. Mm. But what's really interesting about that, I think, is you see the Conservative Party, which used to be predominantly a party about economics, becoming predominantly a party about culture and identity.
Yeah. Did you read that David Aranovich piece in Prospect this month
about piece.
And that was his visit to that conference they had, the NatCon,
the National Conservatives.
And you know, he was on the money. He was talking about a group of people who were presenting a picture of Britain that bears no resemblance to reality. You know, they're talking about a Britain lost in sort of cultural Marxism and narcissism and all of this. People are just out there trying to get on with their lives. You know, they're not in this rabbit hole of kind of demented right-wing populism. And what I also thought was interesting about that piece was he made the point that they draft in people from you know, Trump MAGA people from the America, and they,
lots of them as
and
well.
Lots of them, and all of these think tank people, and then these sort of dimwits on, you know, GB News and that, you know, Darren Grimes and Toby Young and all that ilk, and as an ensemble, they sit there in this conference hall and present a picture of Britain that is absolutely absurd. But they all believe, they all feed off their own kind of
they
fumes,
do, and
you know.
And there's a weirdness to it, which is, it's actually a very old-fashioned view, which is this belief in essentially in economic self-sufficiency, or as the Nazis called it, autarky. You know, and the idea that you can be economically self-sufficient in the 21st century is hilarious. It's actually not worth taking seriously, but they believe that. They think that the answer is stop the immigrants coming in and upskill people to do the work that they're coming here to do.
And it would all be so laughable and entertaining if it wasn't for the fact that these people are now having a gravitational effect on the direction of the Conservative Party in general.
Totally. I mean, they are, there's no doubt that the post-Sunak party is going to be a variety of Brexit populist nativism. Now, it might be more at the Kemi Badenoch, Steve Baker. I can't believe I'm describing Steve Baker at the moderate end of... Yeah.
Well, he's had his conversion, hasn't
he? He's had his conversion. Yeah. But, you know, they are... You know, he disowned Suella Braverman, the Home Secretary, the other day for, it was reported, for her absolutely, you know, inaccurate labelling of the Pakistani community is responsible for most grooming, which is just a lie.
Yeah.
So Baker's distanced himself from Suella Braverman. So there's the bad, not brave Baker end of the Brexit nativist world. And then you've got the full on, you know, the crankies. You've got the National Conservatives who are just getting with these new Conservatives, including, one might note, Lee Anderson.
Who's 30p Lee.
Right, but he's deputy chair of party.
That's right.
His job is to get Rishi re-elected. That's his job.
Yeah.
And yet, I mean, he stayed away from the launch on Monday, but, you know, he's front and centre. And, you know, I think Danny Kruger is the notional leader of the new Conservatives, but Lee Anderson is the sort of engine behind it all. Meanwhile... it's worth mentioning, I mean, just talking about what's... Okay, we're already thinking, I think, well, I know the Conservative Party's thinking anyway, about the post-Rishi era. We should bring in the fourth Matt, because there's us, our glorious producer, Matt Hill, and in the manner of the Cambridge spy ring, the fourth Matt, who I don't think would necessarily like to be included with our number.
Graham Greene,
exactly.
The third man and the fourth Matt.
The third Matt, exactly. Matthew Goodwin, who wrote a book earlier this year, published a book earlier this year called Values, Voice and Virtue, which actually was the subject of my first column for the New European.
It was.
So thank you very much, Professor Goodwin, which posited that Britain is being overtaken by evil liberal elites and everything, and woke blobs, and you know the story, which is ironic really, because I mean actually it's being run by a Brexit elite. But this week he did a kind of very strange for a notional academic, he did a kind of you know, call to arms. Shall we listen to a
go
bit
for
of
it
it
play it yeah
We no longer really own anything. We no longer really make anything, and we no longer prioritise British workers. I'm talking about what we're teaching our children in schools about race, sex and gender, exposing them to ideas which often have no serious basis in science. I'm talking about the fact that Britain now has some of the highest rates of family breakdown in the Western world, and nobody seems to care. Why is this happening? It's happening because the people who run Britain no longer care about the rest of Britain. They're reshaping the country, they're reshaping its institutions around a small university-educated minority who simply don't share the values and the concerns of the rest of the country. They also look down on the rest of the country. I know that because I've been in rooms with them. I've been a university professor for more than 20 years. I know how this new elite think and feel and what they believe. And I've become convinced that millions of people out there think the same as me.
That's enough of you, Forth Matt.
So that is, I find that all a bit depressing, you know, and just...
Well, just depressing? I mean, doesn't it make you want to throw something at the laptop? I mean, it's...
Well, throw something at him.
At him. Yeah. I mean, it's an extraordinary word salad.
Yeah.
Because basically he's just brought together a whole bunch of ideas and thrown them into one kind of speech. And he talks about the people who run Britain. As far as I'm aware, the people who run Britain have been the Conservative Party for quite a while now. And yet what he really means is, and it's a bit vague, bit nebulous, is, you know, universities, the BBC, the media, you know.
Yeah.
And there's a slightly sinister edge to that, because it's as with all conspiracy theories, it's never quite spelt out, but it's meant to trigger resentment.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that I've got two complaints about it in large. One, it was really crappily written. You know, so go back, 3 out of 10, must do better, right? Yes. But secondly, this idea, this recurring theme, which we'll come to over and over again, about they won't let you say that, you can't say what you really think.
He says saying it
to an audience of millions. Richard Littlejohn says saying it to an audience of millions every week. You know, Kelvin McKenzie, all of these guys on talk TV, you know, GB News, all complaining about the lack of platform for people saying exactly what they are currently saying.
As they say it.
Shut up. Yes. Shut up. You're saying it. It's just that a lot of people think you're talking bollocks. That's all. Having the right to say something and having the right to impose that view on a population are two very different things indeed. And one is called free speech, and the other is called authoritarianism. Mm. And what they want is authoritarianism. When they say, you can't say it these days, what they mean is there's too many other people saying what they aren't saying.
Yeah.
So shut up, please, lefty whinging liberals.
I thought that his sentence, which began, I'm convinced that, was doing a lot of work.
Yeah. I wonder what mark he'd give that, by the way, in someone's thesis.
In someone's essay, exactly.
Or, I think, based on absolutely zero evidence whatsoever.
I think everyone agrees with me.
I've come to feel like this. I'm increasingly convinced that what I think is what everyone thinks.
It's like Trump's people are saying.
Yeah.
Which just knew was going to begin a sentence that was not the case.
Yeah.
But I think he's someone who's a very interesting case of, is like an anthropologist that goes native, because he started writing about national populism. And it's quite interesting, actually, because it was early and UKIP was starting, and he spotted that and he wrote about it. And you know, he was sympathetic, but you could tell that what he was writing was sort of, it was useful and informative.
Yeah.
But he's gone native and he believes all this. So there's this kind of strange Mosleyite aura to him now, which is, he obviously wants to...
Well, isn't that the other weird thing about, sorry to group people like Matthew Goodwin in with people like Nigel Farage and Jacob Rees-Mogg, but they all seem to get this sense of personal self-deification where they rise to the front of the national march and they say, here is leadership, follow my flag, I will resolve your issues. You know, there's something very, you know, narcissistic about the whole delivery of that message, I feel, with a lot of these people.
It's narcissistic and it's also dangerous, because you saw The Express this week saying...
I didn't, because I never look at it, but go
on. It was on the BBC, it was on the BBC press preview, so I saw it there, saying something to the effect of stop the courts obstructing the people's will.
Right.
Well, this invocation of the people...
Yeah.
I mean, it has an inglorious history.
Well, it really does. I mean, recently with the Daily Mail, you know, enemies of the people.
And it's dangerous because it undermines the rule of law. It undermines trusted institutions. There's a reason we have, you know, judges separate from politicians. Yeah. And sometimes it doesn't go the way they want it, the way it didn't go right for them over Rwanda. And it might go right for them in the Supreme Court.
It was good of the Express to fit that in between the Brexit is working people slashes.
Brexit is working, although it's been completely thwarted.
Yes.
You know. But the other thing is that there's a strange paradox, because the people you mentioned, like Farage and Rees-Mogg and indeed Professor Goodwin, the fourth Matt, they love to pump themselves up as sort of charismatic leaders who are ready to, you know, take on the burden of national leadership. But they're also fantastic snowflakes.
Yeah.
You know, they love victimhood. You know, Farage with his bank account, which turned out to be not what he'd said at all. And there's Prof Goodwin on Twitter telling anyone who wants to listen about how Britain is run by Alastair Campbell, Emily Maitlis, some yoga instructors or whatever, whoever is the latest evil group.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Jacob Rees-Mogg is very good and on the sort of, not very good, but, you know, he does a lot on the kind of stab in the back, you know, that if only Boris Johnson had been stabbed in the back by the kangaroo court.
That's
of the
privileges.
Now, it's funny, but this is a dangerous game to play.
Yeah. Because I mean, people say dog whistle. These aren't dog whistles.
They're not.
They're foghorns
to
people.
We are way beyond dog whistles. Yeah.
And we should say that there is, you know, a large constituency of people out there who are listening to that and nodding vigorously along to it.
And
they're not going anywhere, those people.
No, not
so
at all.
This is the problem, wasn't it, with Brexit, that and for years after Brexit, if we're honest, is that the two camps were so distinct and so at odds that not enough effort was taken to try and understand and empathise and cajole or, you know, change your own views, compromise, and try and come together and find some common ground. You know, maybe the next battlefield is going to be this, you know, intense right-wing nationalism coming back in a new, mutating out of the remnants of this weak Prime Minister's Conservative Party, and it will rise up into something even nastier than we've seen right now.
Yeah.
And but we have seen in other countries, like in France, and in America, obviously,
America.
Notably, you know, and emerging with AfD in Germany increasingly. So we've got to be I think we carry, and when I say we, I'm talking about people who consider themselves maybe centrists, you know, or certainly against right-wing nationalism.
Yeah.
We think that a harder version of that has gone away forever, but it can resurface any time.
No, I mean, the daftest idea that I hear and have heard for actually decades now is the idea of the pendulum in politics. There is no pendulum in politics. Oddly enough, I hear a lot of business people saying, be all right after the election because the Tory party will pull itself together and the pendulum will swing back to one nation centrism. Well, it's always good to hear that, you know, the more parties in the field that are sane, the better. But what the answer they never have is who exactly? Because Boris Johnson purged them all in 2019. There is no identifiable one nation candidate, and there certainly isn't a taste for it either in the parliamentary party that's going to be or the membership at large. They're not going to get a one nation leader after the election.
Okay, well, great point to leave it. I'm sure we'll pick that up again. Come back and join us after the break.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss. There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
So, Matt, what else on the agenda this week?
As you know, I lead a crazy and wacky life.
You do.
But in reality...
You consume, let me just say, you consume more media than any individual I've ever encountered. I've never thrown anything at you that you haven't already said, yeah, I've read that or I've seen that. But have you also seen...
The brackets has no social life.
Well, obviously, you must be just like on mad... sleepless nights watching everything, listening to everything.
I mean, what can I say? Other than busted. Last night, we're recording this on Thursday. I must confess that I got back from a very pleasant dinner and instead of just going to bed like a normal person, I think, oh, nice, I thought, oh, wow, the new Mark Zuckerberg Meta... social network Threads is going live at midnight. So, being an idiot, I stayed up and joined it, right, and watched it. And I have to say that it wasn't until you put it like that that I now fully reflect upon the weirdness of it. Yeah. But just to give some of the background, we all know Elon Musk's takeover of Twitter has not worked very well, and there's a great piece by James Ball in the current New European about that. And Mark Zuckerberg and Elon Musk are frenemies, I think, verging now towards enemies. And Zuckerberg has long wanted to do a kind of rival to Twitter.
Yeah.
And Threads is it. Shall I tell you what my brief so
yes,
far?
Yes, please.
Well, my view on Twitter is that the problem with Twitter is also what has made it work, which is that, of course, it's toxic and poisonous and horrible, but it appeals to the lizard brain, okay? Whereas Instagram is us being nice, you know, oh, look at my lasagna, right? Yeah, or, celebrating our children. It's the nice side of us, okay? Yeah.
That's right. No one gets into huge personal
battles. There are no Instagram rows, and people who are on Twitter, very, very inclined to be sort of angry and,
And I know from personal experience, much angrier than, I mean, it's like your angriest 3% of your moments in life is 100% of your time on Twitter.
Totally. No, I mean, when my late father was still alive, he would say to me, if I had no, I said, off to have a fight on Twitter, are you? And he was always right. So there is something about Twitter that is obviously, by definition adversarial, not least because the algorithms encourage that. Now, Threads, Zuckerberg posted on Threads today, Thursday, saying, we're definitely focusing on kindness and making this a friendly place.
That could have been it. He's in the room.
I know.
And close your eyes, listeners. He's in the room.
Musk had already tweeted on Twitter, infinitely preferable to be attacked by strangers on Twitter than to indulge in the false happiness of hide the pain Instagram. Right now, hide the pain Instagram, I think, is one of my new favorite phrases. So
I'm expecting the t-shirt any day soon.
Yeah, hide the pain Instagram.
Hide the pain Instagram.
So what we've got here is two competing views of how to do the public square.
Yeah,
and that's actually, it's funny. Yeah. And it's even funnier because, as we've laughed about before, they are in notionally at least going to have a mixed martial arts contest in the Octagon.
I'm going
at
Las
Vegas. We should go because I mean they have spoken to Dana White, the supremo of the UFC, about it. So it's not totally ridiculous.
It would just be the best ever because just a bit of slap. Well, Zuckerberg knows what he's doing.
He does. I mean, he's a jiu-jitsu expert and he's in very good shape. He's 39.
A couple of slaps and I think Elon would just be on the floor asking where it all went wrong.
And it doesn't take much. No. I mean, he'd be on the ground saying, why are you trying to attack me with your hands and also your feet? And I think Zuckerberg... Because, of course, the normal dynamic is that everyone goes, oh, I'm not Zuckerberg. Nice, And Elon Musk is evil, the Bond villain, and, But I think in the ring,
I'd sooner have dinner with Elon Musk than Zuckerberg, wouldn't you?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. No, totally. Because, I mean...
Any day of the week.
I mean, I think the problem Elon Musk has had all along is that he's an engineer.
Yeah.
And he thought that you could bring to Twitter... the logic that has made him successful with Tesla and, to some extent with SpaceX. They're both very, lucrative businesses. apart from apart from their
well,
impressive entrepreneurial
in anyone's book.
But yeah. But Twitter is a, you know, it's crazy town. I mean, you know, it's not an engineering project, and I think it baffled him because he likes trolling. So I think he thought he would be the kind of jolly master of ceremonies, you know, and hurl chaos into
Didn't he call himself Chief Twit or
something?
Yeah,
you know, he's had to resile from that and brought on a new chief executive, Linda Iaccarino, who's got a background in advertising. And he hasn't really nailed the business model. So
well, this is where I think Zuckerberg's got a chance, and maybe we disagree on this. We'll find out in a minute. But speaking as the owner of a business that has a Twitter account, the New European, and we've got 130,000 followers or something like this, they're now asking us to pay, I think it's 1,100 quid a month for one of their ticks.
Yeah.
And now if you don't have one of the ticks, there are certain things you can't do. So it's becoming increasingly less useful to us as a business. And there's just no way it's worth 1,100 quid a month anyway. So, you know, I've been asking myself, why are we on Twitter in the first place? You know, and there must be lots of people thinking this. You know, it's not always good for your brand or reputation. It's becoming increasingly expensive, and it's a time cost as well. You could be doing other things on other platforms that might have greater benefits. Yeah. So, you know,
I mean, I was very surprised he made that elementary mistake, and I thought, this is not augur well for Musk's custody of Twitter, because the blue tick was, as envisaged in the Jack Dorsey era of Twitter, was a useful thing, which was, you know, there were so many people pretending to be well-known people, often politicians, that it was a verification thing.
Yeah.
And you need that, actually, because, you know, if you're talking about Rishi Sunak or Keir Starmer or Donald Trump or Joe Biden, or, you know, there are going to be hundreds of imposters.
Yeah.
I mean, there's an imposter Billy Bratt. I mean, there are all sorts of things.
And they're all verified now.
Well,
because they're paying
the idea that you can buy verification is ridiculous. Now, there was a potentially smart idea, which is subscription is better than advertising, because the Twitter model and what drove some of the toxicity was algorithms sort of cluster around clickbait, and that drives advertising, and the things that get more advertising are the things that are more, you know, sort of wild, whereas a subscription model to some extent would perhaps have calmed that a little. But he muddled two completely separate things. So one of the things I find very difficult on Twitter now is I really don't know whether this tweet by notionally from a famous politician is from a famous politician.
You have to go and check it.
And you have to go and check it.
And see how many followers they've got.
Just sort of in the day-to-day business of journalism is a pain.
Yeah.
So if the area where I think Zuckerberg might score is, I don't believe he's going to turn the public square into a kind of milk and honey kumbaya place. I think that's impossible. But if he was able to restore some authority to social networks, that's, you know, prose-based social networks, that's interesting.
So, you know, is Threads the place where you can go and have a row with the people that you're being nice to on Instagram? If you want to go and have a row with them on Threads.
Well, I think the interesting thing is exactly that, which is the intimacy of its link to Instagram is fascinating, because Instagram has 2 billion followers. And clearly Zuckerberg is thinking, we're not getting as much juice out of them as we could.
Yeah.
On Nicergram, you know, Nicergram is where you go to say nice things, right? We all do.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that Threads will be as sort of poisonous and adversarial as Twitter, but he's obviously thought that I could get more. So the first thing when you sign up to Threads is they just import all your Instagram contacts. So it's intimately connected. One of the questions that will arise out of this, I think, is how powerful can Mark Zuckerberg get? Because he now has potentially a significant social network.
Yeah, well, Facebook, Instagram, Threads.
He has Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp.
Yeah, WhatsApp, of course.
I mean, no one in the world
has had that.
If Threads works,
yeah.
no one ever will have had as much control over
That's right.
public discourse.
I mean, it makes literally makes Murdoch look like a guy on a soapbox in Hyde Park Corner.
Murdoch is
marginal.
It's marginal.
Yeah. Here's a big question for you, right? Put all these billionaires to one side. Would the world be a better place without social media if it never existed?
No, because for all its horror show, and some of it is horror show, a lot of it is horror show, it has enabled people to form connections on a professional, entrepreneurial, intellectual level. The bits of Twitter that, to be honest, journalists don't often visit, you know.
Yeah.
And it's been hugely important in, it was important in the Arab Spring. It's important now in Ukraine.
Movements.
Yeah. You know, it's
Me
like,
Too.
You know, Black Lives Me Matter. Too. It's how do you connect?
Yeah.
How do you get the world to know?
Yeah.
As they're getting bored of the Ukraine conflict, that actually there is still huge suffering in Mariupol or Kiev or whatever. Twitter is a very useful.
But against that is, I kind of agree with that assessment that generally it's social media in general is a force for good. But I don't think there's any doubt that it's made a huge number of people angrier, less happy, less content. You know, even to the extent that, you know, to touch on Elon Musk's point about, you know, ignore the pain or hide the pain, you know, seeing this constant presentation of people's lives as being something joyful and wonderful, you know, and trying to reconcile that with the grim reality of your own life, and then engaging in the same lie about your own life being nothing but a procession of wonderful moments, you know, it has, I think, changed society significantly, but almost without us noticing. And I do think there's a broad, a kind of chronic downside to social media that is mitigated by the kind of big important things it enables. But I would reckon there's a lot of people who are less happy today than they were 20 years ago because of social media.
There is a lot of damage has been done to the whole political process by social media.
No doubt about that. Yeah.
And, I think it's fair to say, actually, that probably Brexit wouldn't have happened without social media. This is very contentious. A lot of people say, no, you know, it would. But the targeting of advertising, where you could have Vote Leave or Leave EU saying simultaneously, for instance, if you vote Brexit, we'll be able to really protect animal rights.
Yeah.
Or if you vote Brexit, we'll finally be able to restore fox hunting.
Yes.
Just to take two completely random examples. And I think that...
And targeting very distinct audiences.
And it's very hard to get hold of those adverts. You know, the micro-targeting is very difficult to track. So James Ball makes this point very well, I think, which is that 2024 is probably going to be a huge year for elections in the UK, on the continent, and finally in November in the US. And these social media networks we have are not up to the task.
Yeah.
And I'd certainly agree with him on that.
Yeah, no, me too. Okay. So what have we talked about this week?
Well, a bit of culture. I mean, we've talked about culture in the kind of dead serious way.
Yeah.
But I've had a fun week just in the sort of retro culture.
Yeah, I know you have, yeah.
I saw the restored Ziggy Stardust movie, and it was on the 50th anniversary of the show at Hammersmith. And it's beautifully restored, and it was wonderful to watch. And, you know, it's not particularly original or incisive to observe that he was a genius. Yeah. And
I mean, I've seen the original many times.
Yeah.
How is this more effective or different?
They've really, really gone to work. It's 4K on screen.
Right.
And they've really gone to work on the quality. Right. And then, for the real saddos amongst us, myself included, they've restored the Jeff Beck footage, which for some reason was not in the original.
Right, okay.
So cool. If that's the kind of thing you get excited about, which it is cool. Right. The other thing which I watched... which, again, the power of retro pop never ceases to amaze me, is Netflix has just dropped a documentary about Wham. Mm. And, you know, if you told me when I was buying those records in the early 80s that 2023 there'd be a documentary about that very short 4 years where George Michael and Andrew Ridgeley owned
pop
music, I'd have been slightly puzzled because I love those records, but I'd have thought by then.
Yeah.
It's a great documentary.
Fantastic.
Ridgeley's, you know, very impressive, very eloquent.
Yeah.
It's quite triste because it's about the end of a friendship. And,
no, of course.
And, of course, it leads, you know, no spoilers, it leads, though it's not dealt with in this documentary, to the sort of George Michael's emergence unraveling as a massive world superstar and then sad decline.
Yeah,
it fascinates me that pop music, which started off as a sort of Mayfly idiom, you know, that was kind of here and gone tomorrow, has become actually like the classics, you know.
Well, have you been to ABBA Voyage?
Not yet.
Mate, honestly.
Alistair Campbell tells me it's like, he's been several times. I will go. So
for context, I remember the first cassette I ever got given was when it was ABBA's Greatest Hits Volume
ABBA Gold
2.
It was before Gold.
It was well before Gold. I'd have been about 8 years old, I guess, something like this. So it would have been 77, 78, something like that. I remember my granny parking in Waterloo Road in Crosby. There was a record shop in Crosby. Going in and seeing this on the wall. I can remember it like yesterday.
No.
And with the grey cover and buying it and listening to ABBA. And I've always loved ABBA. You know,
ABBA, brilliant.
Fantastic.
Perfect pop.
Mate, when you go and see this, I don't want to sound like a PR man for ABBA Voyage, but it is something else. I mean, they are there.
Yeah.
They're there in front of you. They're not holograms. They're people.
Yeah.
You know, there's one very weird moment, and it's for a second, where one of the women backs up as she's dancing, and you can see her backside sort of buffers a bit. It's kind of pixelates, and it's that. But I only mention that to tell you just how disturbing that is within that, what you're actually seeing. And there's a live band playing to the side, and the auditorium's amazing. And I think the auditorium is kind of portable, so it can collapse and get taken to other cities. But if you're of our age and you're an ABBA fan, definitely try.
I will
go
definitely
see it.
I mean, the hologram thing is amazing.
And just to add to our cultural,
you've had a big week. And
well, so
ongoing.
I saw Jarvis Cocker
amazing.
At Finsbury Park. Top marks to Jarvis Cocker, less marks to Finsbury Park as a venue.
You really?
Had to queue for about an hour and 10 minutes for a beer. It was awful. Hackney Council, get your act together. It was terrible.
Pull your finger out.
Yeah, but also tonight I'm going to see
the boss.
At
Where
Hyde
are you
Park.
Seeing him?
Hyde Park. Yeah.
I gather that.
So I've never seen him live, and
I saw him at Glasto a bunch of years ago, and he was absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
And people who've seen him recently tell me that he's in storming form.
This is Bruce Springsteen, in case people don't know who the boss is.
The boss, but, yes.
Yeah.
It's complicated because, of course, Matt Kelly is the boss.
I am the boss. Bruce Springsteen
is the big boss.
Yeah.
I mean, he is kind of... He's the person, in a way, who, more than anyone in pop culture that we're talking about, I mean, Elton, I suppose, is up there.
Yeah.
But the Stones. But the stamina. I mean,
Here's a controversial point of view. Everyone raving about Elton, who I love, who I went to see at Madison Square Garden for my 50th birthday.
That's a great way to celebrate it.
But I was sitting there thinking, what's the difference between Paul McCartney and Bruce Springsteen and Elton John? Of course, Elton John didn't write any of the words to his songs.
No.
So I do not think Elton John is qualified to stand in that ultimate pantheon of rock gods, because
it's interesting, isn't it?
He didn't
write
anything.
When you were listening to all those, you know, amazing, you know, banger after banger after banger at the Glastonbury set, you're right. The music is magnificent and soaring.
The performance is magnificent. Everything.
But what makes Tiny Dancer one of the greatest songs of all time is Bernie Taupin's weird, magical language, you know.
The poetry.
Jesus
of it,
freaks out in the street, handing tickets out to God.
That's right.
Where does that come from?
That's right.
So, no, I agree with you. That's kind of a...
Well, sadly, we haven't had time to talk about any of that.
Yeah.
We must talk about it sometime. Talk about it sometime.
We must remit it, as they say in the Labour Party, to another occasion.
Brilliant. Remember, the latest edition of The New European is on the newsstands now, as well as on our website. There's got that brilliant piece that we talked about at length in the first half by Giles Wilkes. And there's plenty more, lots and lots of culture stuff in The New European every single week. And podcast listeners get a great deal on subscription. Head to theneweuropean.co.uk/2MATS. That's the number 2, MATTS. There's a link in the show notes. Just tell them I sent you. Thank you to producer Matt Hill at Rethink Audio, as always. And until next week...
It's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from him. Goodbye.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.